Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting baby boomer women with professional peers. Advice you can use to be more confident in your financial future. Inspiration to take control of your personal finances. With Lynn S. Evans, Certified Financial Planner.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. There was a time in my life not long ago when I believed three things about money. One, women are not supposed to talk about or be included in any conversations about money. Two, women don't have the natural ability to understand anything about money. And three, men know best how to manage money. And those truths I made up about money guided me for years until I realized money was not a foreign language or some other obscure academic exercise, and it was something I could not only understand but teach to other women. Too many times I've heard stories from women who ought to know better but didn't, until they were forced to, because of divorce, widowhood, job loss, or the approach of retirement. This podcast will add another chapter to an ongoing informative conversation about financial topics women should be more knowledgeable about. My mission is to help women reduce their financial illiteracy and develop a healthy, confident relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Margarita Cheng, otherwise known as Rita. And Rita is the Chief Executive Officer at Blue Ocean Global Wealth. She's the past spokesperson for the AARP Financial Freedom Campaign and a regular columnist for Investopedia and Kiplinger. She's a member of CNBC Digital Financial Advisor Council, and she's a CFP professional, a chartered retirement planning counselor, a retirement income certified professional, and a certified divorce financial analyst. As a certified financial planner Board of Standards ambassador, Margarita helps educate the public, policymakers, and media about the benefits of competent, ethical financial planning. She serves as a Women's Initiative Advocate and member of the Diversity Advisory Board for the CFP Board. She served on the Financial Planning Association National Board of Directors and is a past president of the Financial Planning Association of the National Capital Area. Welcome, Rita.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here today.
I'm glad because we have so many wonderful things to talk about today. And I'm just going to jump right in. I just read that article that you wrote a couple years ago. And as you told me off air, it was around Father's Day. And the inspiration for this article came from some lessons that you learned from your father, which in and of itself is a real anomaly because most young women don't learn much about money from their fathers. But your father apparently was a visionary who saw that there was some value in explaining, first of all, what is the definition of wealth? I don't know if you remember writing those words in the article, but it was really brilliant. It was that you said his mantra was that financial wealth alone does not represent one's true wealth. And he taught you not to define yourself by how much you had, by what it did with, but what you did with what you had. And you said you learned early on not to let money be the sole determining factor for the decisions you made in life, but also learned that although money couldn't buy happiness, it could provide peace of mind, freedom, and flexibility. And obviously, you're very thankful for what it is that your father explained to you. I think it's unusual that, first of all, that your father was an immigrant. He came to this country with, I think you said, $17 in his pocket. And he taught you some values around wealth that most American children today never hear, ever. What were some of those values?
Well, absolutely. Thank you so much. So my dad fled communist China, and he went to university in Taiwan. The timeline gets a little bit fuzzy because my dad's birth certificate was burned, he knows he was born somewhere between 1931 and 33. And so he picked his birthday as 10-10-32. He served in the Taiwanese military. Exactly. He's like, I can remember 10-10, double 10 day. My dad's family lost everything, and he had to rebuild his life twice. And he told me this at a very young age, that money doesn't buy happiness, but it does give you peace of mind. And more money brings you more opportunities, and you should not squander those opportunities. My dad was also this is very funny. I'm the eldest of three girls. And in China, for traditional families, boys are favored. And when my dad came to this country, people would say to Paul, that's my dad's English name, you know, as he settled down and expanded his family with my mom and dad had three girls. And my dad was always so funny. People would say, Paul, you have three girls. How are you going to pay for these weddings? And he would joke, because my dad's Chinese, my mom's American. He's like, oh, Chinese culture, the boy pays for the weddings. It was just so funny. But my dad really, to answer your question, my dad had the mindset that money's for everybody. Meaning, I don't care if you're a boy. I don't care if you're a girl. You need to know this stuff. Now, my dad was a little bit strict. I wrote this down. He took that to a whole new level. He said, Rita, you need to know about money. You need to know about cars. And you need to know about technology. Now, I wish he pushed me to learn more about home improvement, but that's another conversation for another day. Those top three, cars, money, and tech, I think have served me really well. But he basically told me that education was not an expense. It was an investment. It was an investment in my future, and that I should never stop learning. And I should never be complacent. My dad was very intense. If you asked a question, you know, he wouldn't just give you the answer. He would want you to try to discover the answer on your own. And even when it came to calculations, he was brilliant at math. He wouldn't allow me to use a calculator. Like, I had to do everything by hand. And then he allowed me to use a calculator. And it wasn't enough to use a scientific calculator or a financial calculator. I had to learn how to use both.
Well, that must have...
That was very intense.
Yeah, but that must have served you well when you sat for the CFP exam, because... Those HP, whatever they called them, those crazy calculators we had to use to figure out present value and future value and discounted values. Man, that was tough. If you know how to play with those things, more power to you. That was pretty awesome.
So it's interesting you say that, because I believe that the financial planning profession is an amazing opportunity for everybody, but particularly women. And actually, how I built my confidence was because I am actually good at math and I like math. So you're right, it did serve me well. That HP 12C, let me tell you, like, I knew how to do all those time value calculations. And that gave clients a lot of credibility and trust in me, because if someone asked me, you know, on that graph, why does it go up and why does it spike up and drop down? Or what's this net present value? What does this mean? Like, I could explain to them, and it helped me become more confident. I might not have been the best salesperson, but clients knew that I knew what I was talking about.
Exactly. That's wonderful. That's really great to hear that, because I think that was one of the biggest issues that most women had to overcome early on in this profession, that the assumption was the girls weren't good at math. So if you weren't good at math, how could you possibly be a good financial planner when just about everything you did was about numbers?
But girls and women are good listeners.
They have
empathy. And that is very powerful. People want to be heard. They want to be understood.
They do. And so let's go into something before I get into all that other stuff that I really want to get back to, the things your dad taught you. We're going down a path of something that I think is critically important that we talk about. And that is, in your role as ambassador to the CFP Board of Standards, you're an ambassador to try to help people, and especially women, enter this profession. And as we've talked about offline a little earlier, both of us understand the significant difference or differences between the way men and women operate, but how we function as financial planners. And there is a difference. Why don't you tell me about what you said about how you see the differences playing out?
Well, absolutely. So my role as a certified financial planner, board of standards, or CFP board ambassador is to educate the public, policymakers, and media on the benefits of ethical financial planning advice. Public also includes people who may be interested in joining our profession. So, and that includes people who are not here yet, or for people who are here in our profession, helping them find a way. Women and men do have differences, and because people are different, that's actually not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing because it allows clients to be able to have access to more options and strategies. Women are more, as I mentioned, collaborative and relational when it comes to wealth management and financial planning. And these differences can only, they're additive. They are not taking anything away. They can only improve the client's experience.
Yeah, I agree with
you. The diversity of thought, diversity of opinion, diversity of perspective is very helpful because then you can see the world through someone else's lens.
And I think you're right when you say diversity is not necessarily diversity ethnically, sexual, gender. We're not talking about that kind of diversity. We're talking about diversity of thinking. And I think that people don't really understand that that difference in thinking is, as you said, it's additive. It is something that only enhances the relationship. But the problem is the fact that when we are trained, most training programs for certified financial planners take the perspective of how men think and how men place priorities on certain types of focus when they're talking about financial planning, such as, I think men are more interested in looking at performance of investment portfolios and judging the value of relationships based on how well they outperformed what everybody else has been doing. They also think it's important to talk about the nuts and bolts of things. How do you structure a certain type of investment portfolio? How much do you put in certain assets and allocations of certain assets? Women, on the other hand, I think are far more interested in knowing about how do I reach the goals that I want. I don't really care about the numbers, and I don't really care about whether or not you beat the guy next door. I want to know that you're going to tell me how I can achieve the goal that I want. And I'm not saying that men don't care about that, but I think women place a higher priority on that in choosing a relationship with a financial advisor than men do. Is that your experience?
It absolutely is my experience. And when I think about the sales training I received, it's true. I've heard people say you cannot be what you cannot see. But when I entered the profession, you know, I was a young mom. I had a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old. And I was very coachable. I did what my managers told me to do. But then it came a point in time when I'm like, you know what? I am who I am, Sam. I am. I'm Margarita. I'm doing what they're telling me to do. But at the end of the day, I realized that clients actually wanted to hear from me. They wanted to hear my story. And they told me in these anonymous surveys, so they're not even surveys that I created. Our firm would send out these surveys to benchmark, really, truly, it was benchmark, or maybe I should say measure client satisfaction and retention. And it wasn't until my results started coming back where people were like, well, Rita, what are you doing? I said, well, I really focus on the process. I also focus on the progress that the clients are making. And that, yes, that resonates more with women, but guess what? Men value that too. So I definitely agree with you that sometimes advisors in general like overemphasize portfolio management or the performance. And that's not to say that's not important. We can't retire if we don't have money. But making it more personal And relating it to the client's goals is really very valuable, especially talk about the threat of robo-advice. Mm-hmm. Robo-advisors are going to be good asset allocators. They're going to deliver good performance. But a robo is not necessarily going to be able to have meaningful, enriching conversations and explain how strategy ABC is going to help the client be more intentional with their wealth and reach their goals.
Yeah, I agree. Let's go back to where I dropped off here. We went down this path, but your father taught you some very important lessons about money. And I'd just love to have your comments about these. The first one was to teach your children to work hard. And then you referenced the fact that you teach your children that they get paid to do the work they do. And if they don't do the work, they don't get paid. I don't know how that would resonate with many parents today, because I think children just expect an allowance, and not in exchange for any work, but just because they're kids. That's very different than what your father taught you. And I wonder what your comments are on something like that.
Sure, absolutely. So when I talk to the media about kids and money, the first thing I say is you ultimately have to do what is consistent with your family and your value system. Allowance is a very large topic. So to that point, when I was growing up, I saw that kids got straight A's and they got A's for their report card. Now, I never asked my dad, where's my money? Why did I get straight A's? I'm mm-hmm. smart enough to know, don't go there with dad. But I remember my dad said this to me. He's like, your job is to do well and perform well in school. My job is to make sure you have. You can imagine him saying this, clothes on your back, food on the table, and a roof over your head. Mm-hmm. But where my dad was going with this is he really wanted us to know that we have a skill. So when I say teach your children to work, you know, whether that's babysitting, tutoring math, coaching swimming, teaching swim lessons, maybe they're good at digital photography. It is not the money they make, but it is how they're learning to communicate. It also helps them build confidence. So ultimately, I think it's very important for families to do what is comfortable for them and consistent with their values and their family structure. But the takeaway is we all have skills and talents, and it goes beyond the $8, $10, $12, $15 that your kid will make. It teaches them, they feel very empowered and confident, and that's worth far more than the money they earn.
Yeah, I agree. Second one was to give your children vision. Explain what that means.
So give them vision, help them set goals. It doesn't even have to be a big goal. So here's what I mean is my youngest daughter just entered high school. She started high school year. So yes, as parents, we do know best. But I think it's also important as your kids become more mature to get their inputs. And that's part of vision. So what would they like to do? What interests do they have? Because me telling my kid, there's certain things that our kids have to do. They have to brush their teeth. They have to take English to graduate from high school. They have to take math. I get that. But as far as electives and things that they enjoy to do, how they want to spend their summer, what class they want to take, you know, let them verbalize, let them express their goals. That's part of having vision. I think that's really important.
I do too. Yeah, and I don't think a lot of people really have those kinds of conversations with their kids. They tell them what they want them to do. You know, you will start taking tuba lessons this summer. Well, what if I don't like tubas? Well, you got to learn some musical instrument. So I don't agree with that. I think people need to really encourage your children to dream and to think about the kinds of things that they love and to pursue them. I think that's great. Number three was to help them learn to save. And we all know that works, but I thought you had a very interesting objective in your savings plan. What was that?
So when I was a child, as I told you before we started our conversation.
Yes, that one.
So I'm the eldest of three girls, and I've always been good with my money. I mean, I used to get money for Christmas, and I also get money for Chinese New Year, and I get money for my birthday. I would never squander my money. I would save it. My splurge purchase, I think that it's important to allow kids to have vision or a goal or what they want to do with their money. So my first splurge purchase was Ray-Bans. I wasn't going to buy cheap sunglasses, and I took care of my Ray-Bans. They had a case. I'm serious. I was 10 years old. And when I tell my kids that, they think I'm very cool. They're like, Mom, that's amazing. You know, Ray-Bans, they're still around today. I'm like, I'm not that old. But so absolutely. Well, I mean, I think money is first. My dad told me this, money's for spending, but you need to spend wisely. The word intent is really important. We use it a lot today, but I think my dad was spending with intention a long time ago.
I think so. And I love the fact that your first purchase was something that was expensive. It was something that was something you really, you wanted it. And so you saved for it. You didn't really care what people thought about what you were doing. And I think that's great. I think we sometimes lose that piece of it, that saving for something that might appear to be a luxury to others is something that's very self-satisfying when you can accomplish it. And it spurs you on to do more. And I think that was great. You and your Ray-Bans. I love it. And the fourth one was to talk to them about investing. Now that could be a very difficult conversation to try to explain to children what that all means. So how would you suggest that people talk to their kids about investing?
So this is what I tell people. When you're talking to your children about money, the first thing that you have to do is make sure it's age appropriate and relevant. So if you have a toddler screaming in a toy store and you're like, no, we're not buying that, because you can't tell them you're putting money in a 529 plan. That's not going to make sense, right? But no. As your kids get older, maybe like middle school, late elementary school, middle school, high school, you can, when the statements come, again, this is, you have to tailor it to your family and what you're comfortable with. I thought it was important that my children see, hey, when these statements come, this is money for your college. I save money every month. We're going to do this together. So I think that it's important. Then when my daughter had her first job, first internship, she was actually offered, she was eligible to participate in the 401k. So that's another opportunity to talk about it. So I think it's important to make sure that it's something you're comfortable speaking with and it's relevant and age appropriate. So I didn't just talk about investing out of the sky. So if we're talking about colleges, we talk about how much money we have set aside and what's possible. And that also leads to a good conversation about, you know, student loan debt and what's comfortable or what's sustainable and what's not.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll get to that one in a minute. But the other one then is teach them to give. I love that idea. And I love the reference you made to World Vision. That is a wonderful opportunity to teach children about choosing practical gifts such as chickens, goats, and clean water for children and families in other parts of the world. I don't think they really understand anything beyond, I'm saying younger children, beyond the world of their school and the kids that they hang out with in their neighborhood. I think that exposure to other children around the world it's a wonderful opportunity for kids to get to know that it's not like their house everywhere.
Absolutely. So my dad's Chinese, my mom is American, I was born here, I grew up here. My husband is Chinese Indonesian, so he was born in Indonesia and he's multiracial. So we would take the children to see their Indonesian relatives. Indonesia is a developing nation. And, you know, I remember one time our wireless printer wasn't working. And it is hardship, like when things aren't working fast. You know, you're under deadline. It's frustrating when technology doesn't work fast. But I think visiting other people and seeing other parts of the world help them really appreciate what they have. So Joe, my husband, his family has internet and things are fast. But when you go to the country, more rural areas, there might not be like a hot shower. There might not be high-speed internet. There's certainly not cable TV. And so it really makes you appreciate what you have. that's a little bit far from home, but closer to home, Thanksgiving, not just turkey baskets, that's very important, but diapers and baby food and formula for families. These things are expensive, and so we would put together these baskets, and we had this tradition of doing that, and then supporting the Giving Tree, because we talked about earning money, saving money, spending money, but now it's like sharing and giving.
Yeah. Number six is show them how to budget, and you suggest maybe through an app, which to them and in their world today, that would be the ideal place to start. How do you teach children how to budget?
I mean, you can start, you can, as I mentioned, you can make it age appropriate and relevant. So even back to school shopping, you can start there. Maybe when you're getting school supplies, you look what's on the list, you see what you have around the house, and this actually interrelates because it sometimes if you buy in bulk, it's cheaper, but you may not need everything. And so you can buy in bulk and then set aside what you don't need and then pack a backpack for other children, maybe in a neighboring community who don't have a brand new backpack with new gear. So you can use apps, but you can also just say, hey, here's our budget. Here's what you need to get. The other thing is they can put things in a shopping cart online and they can save it. And then you can go in there and check. And if you don't think anything belongs in there, you can always ask them to remove it. So there's ways in which you can engage your kids and make it a learning experience. The other thing is, like, when we're talking about digital and apps, my kids are all very good about, like, searching for coupon codes online.
Oh, right. Yes. That's great. That's really good. You also mentioned this in here that as soon as your child is old enough to start filling up a piggy bank, they can begin saving. When the piggy bank is full, set up a savings account and let them manage it. Have you done that with your children?
Absolutely. They all have savings accounts. The older ones have checking accounts. Obviously, the younger one can't have a checking account. And it's really helpful because it also teaches them budgeting. They cannot move too much from their savings accounts, because I think the financial institution limits the number of transactions. Mm-hmm. But I'm here to tell you, they're all pretty like responsible. And I think they also appreciate me, because my eldest daughter said to me, like, Mom, like, I'm helping my friend with her student loans. Where do people find out this information? I'm like, they don't.
Yeah, that's true. They don't. And you talk about debt. That's a perfect segue to warn your children about debt. And you mentioned good debt and bad debt. I think we should probably define that, because there's some debt that's good. I mean, and to me, traditionally, that means things like mortgages for a home, because the equity is building, hopefully, in a home. But there's also bad debt. And I think that for a lot of kids, especially those in college, they used to push a lot for children to sign up for credit cards. And they never explained to them that you can put anything you want on a credit card, but there's this bill that comes at the end of every month and you have to pay it. And I have seen juniors and seniors in college come to me in tears because they have no idea how all of this happened. It just kind of snowballed. And they are looking at a situation where before they get out of school with a degree in their hand, they've got $20,000 and $30,000 worth of credit card debt. And then we add on top of that college tuition debt. So let's talk about how do we explain the value of debt and the warnings about debt to children.
So one of my finance professors explained this. Sometimes, yes, there's good debt and there's bad debt, but let's define what's good. Let's define what's bad. So to borrow money to get an education, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but you need to make sure that the money you're borrowing, you can afford to pay it back. So that's not to say that you should not pursue certain degrees. You just need to make sure that you're borrowing just what you need. Just because you're eligible for a loan doesn't necessarily mean that you need to take it out. If you have scholarships or you work, you may not need that unsubsidized loan. So don't take it. Don't take that unsubsidized loan and then go to Mexico for spring break, because it's really going to be costing you. No, my daughter told me that's what people do. She's like, Mom, I just don't know how people do it.
Wow.
They say that they're broke, but then they take these loans out that they don't really need and they go to spring break.
Wow.
So that's an example of what I mean. I want to make sure that I'm not lecturing people and saying they shouldn't borrow money for school. Borrow what you need, but don't borrow any more. The other thing is that my professor said, when you're like borrowing money, look at the life asset. Look at how long you'll have the asset. So listen, no one likes the car note, but if your car is high mileage and it's not safe, time is money and your safety and your well-being are number one. So if you have to have a new car or you need a better car, maybe you don't get a brand new one off the lot, but you need to have reliable transportation. So if your car note, let's say, is for 5 years and there's nothing wrong with your car when it's paid, see if you can extend the life of the asset beyond the 5 years you paid for it. So if you had a car and it's a 5-year payment and you pay it off and it's still running, meaning it's not a money pit, see if you can keep the car and extend the life of the car even to like 7 years or 8 years. I know some car, and it depends on the weather where you live, that might not be appropriate. So it's a balancing act. It can hold you back from reaching your goals.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we do have to have debt. Like if we need reliable transportation, like sometimes it could take a long time to take public transportation. Sometimes you may be better served having a car because your time is money. So it's a balancing act.
It is. And then I think the last one we have to talk about before we run out of time here is one that is really, really significant in this day and age. And that is, don't solve their problems for them. Let me just set that up. Parents like to fix things for their kids. We don't like to see our children suffer. Unfortunately, alleviating the pain associated with bad financial decisions fosters financial ignorance, even if it's as simple as fronting the money to your 10-year-old to buy the latest video game after he nickeled and dimed away his allowance. That is so true. That is what people do all the time. We have to stop doing that, because that's really what lets them know that there's always the bank of mom and dad to rescue them if they make any bad decisions or if they just can't seem to come up with what they need to get what they want.
Absolutely. I mean, I have retired clients who are in this situation. I understand illness, job loss, death, disability. These all happen. And sometimes it can be very difficult for my clients to say no to their kid. They want to help their kid, but they're worried about their retirement. And clients come to me, they're like, what should I do? And I think working them with them in a financial planning relationship helps guide the conversation. I can say to the client, you can help your kid, your adult child. You can either help them, give them a lump sum, or you're able to provide $800 a month assistance for the next 3 years, either or. Any more than that, it's going to compromise your financial security, and then they'll have to help you. This is very helpful. One of my clients said this, that was extremely helpful, because he didn't want to say no to his kid, but he was also worried that his kid would never learn.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's interesting that I tell clients, if your adult child is asking for help, of course you want to help them. I would never tell a client, do not help your kid. But if your kid keeps returning to the bank of mom and dad, and they're going on vacations, they're driving the latest and greatest car, and they're asking for help, but they're like, no, mom and dad, that's not your business. Well, they just ask you for help. Their personal finance has become your business. So it's okay for you to be asking about their business, because their business has become your business.
That's right.
And when I told that to a client, like, he high-fived me. He's like, Misha, this was like the best meeting. Like, you can go home now.
Now, don't
that was
you
extremely
find,
helpful.
Yes, and don't you find that you are often made out to be the bad guy? But, you know, they can say, well, I'm sorry, but I talked to my financial planner today, and it's just not going to be possible. it makes it so much easier to blame us.
It is. And I don't mind being the bad person, because the thing is, this goes back to being a fiduciary and doing what's in the client's best interest. Yep. And I didn't say they couldn't help their adult child. I just said, you know what? If your adult child needs you to pay 100% of the mortgage, it's going to be a little bit difficult because you're going to have to withdraw with too much money. It's going to go in the next tax bracket. You can help them, but just not at that level, because then you'd be harming yourself. But absolutely, I feel like I want to fix everybody's problems. Like, I don't feel fulfilled unless I've solved the world's problems.
And I want to tell you, I think most women would say the same thing. Yeah, I know. We want everybody to be happy. We do.
I feel like I'm at my best when I'm putting out multiple fires and everybody's smiling, right? I feel fulfilled.
Yes, yes, yes. It's great. It's really good. Let me switch this conversation around to something that I really would love to know, and that is your relationship with money from the time that you were a child. We heard about what your father taught you, but how about your first memory around money?
Gosh, my first money memory. I mean, I would have to say my first money memory is, so as I mentioned, my dad is Chinese, my mom is American. So my first money memory is probably my grandmother giving me a red envelope. Red envelope is what you put money in for Chinese New Year. It was so special to me. So I would say that's probably my first money memory, receiving a red envelope. It was something very positive. So that's good, I guess, right?
Yeah. What did you do with the money that was in that envelope when it became Chinese New Year? Did you spend it on something?
I mean, I saved, you know what, we're allowed to spend it, but I think I saved it. And, you know, my kids are the same way. Like, my son will have a stack of cash. I'm like, where did this money come from? He's like, oh, well, my birthday money, my Chinese New Year money, this money. So in some ways, they're very much like me.
Oh, like, we I wonder where they got it from.
Right. Right. So I would say that's my first money memory. That's a very positive money memory. But that is my first money memory.
Okay.
There is a money memory that's not so positive that was early on. I remember that, and this is why my dad was very insistent on talking about money. Not to the point where he is obsessed about it. He just thought that this is his philosophy. If you don't talk about it, doesn't mean there's not going to be issues. And if you talk about it, doesn't mean there won't. It's important for everybody to be informed. So a money memory that was a little bit traumatic is I remember my aunt died, and she didn't have any life insurance. She had four children, and she was married, but she was more of the stay-at-home mom, the caregiver. And my dad didn't judge. My dad paid for the funeral. He didn't say, why don't you have life insurance? My dad, he was very practical, but he's like, you know what? Everyone should be able to have a service. And he cared a lot about dignity. And so he's like, no, you don't need to pay me back. I'm going to pay for the funeral. My dad was always prepared.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is the most threatening to your financial security?
Me personally? My yes. financial security?
Yes.
I mean, I would say if I have a chronic disease, like Parkinson's, my dad had Parkinson's. My dad did have long-term care insurance.
He did or did
but
not?
But I know that he did. I recommended that he get it.
Okay.
So if you were to ask me what is like threatening, like if I were to get a chronic condition like that, like, I mean, I have listeners, Margarita has disability insurance, Margarita has life insurance, Margarita has long-term care. And Margarita's husband is a federal employee, so she has good health insurance. Margarita likes insurance, but still, like if I were to have a condition like that, I think it would compromise my ability to leave legacy to my children.
Yes.
And that's important to me.
Okay. Why?
I think it's important because you always want to, it doesn't mean that you want to do everything for your children, but I know that my dad only came here. He didn't come here that long ago, maybe 55 years ago. He died 5 years ago. I think that leaving a legacy, it doesn't really matter what that is, but that will be for my kids and their kids. So that's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have to start from scratch.
Okay. What are some of the best and the worst financial decisions you've ever made?
Oh, I can tell you what the worst one is.
Okay.
So the worst one is kind of funny. Remember I said you never should let money be the deciding factor? Well, I actually violated that rule. I was an exchange student. I lived in Tokyo, Japan. At that time, Tokyo was actually more expensive than San Francisco and New York City, Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be frugal. I wanted to make my dollars last. So I lived in a place that was a little bit, Japan is a very safe country, but the place I lived was a little bit industrial. It was a neighborhood undergoing transition. Put it this way, it wasn't the safest neighborhood. So I got stalked and attacked, and I had to move. And it's at that point when, like, I realized that I didn't necessarily heed Dad's advice. Now, Dad didn't lecture me. He actually came to visit me to make sure I was okay. Mm-hmm. And so that was a bad decision I made with my money. No one got hurt. I mean, I'm okay. At that time, my mom was like, you should come home to America. I'm like, no, Mom, the semester's already started. What am I going to do, sit in America, like, at home, not be able to go to school? My dad asked me, what do you think you should do? And I said, you know what, Dad? I think I need to continue with school here. I came here to study. If I go home, I'm losing everything. And I think about the other people who applied for this scholarship and opportunity and didn't win. And that wouldn't be fair for them. So my dad's like, well, okay, I'm glad you're talking through this. And he came to visit me. And then I moved to another place that was closer to the city where I didn't have such a long commute. So that was a bad decision. A good decision is I scrimped and scraped and I saved money and I bought my house in 1997, right after we had my daughter.
Okay. So you scrimped and saved and bought the house. Was your husband in on that?
He was. Okay. Because he saw that I was very serious. He saw I was very serious because I had saved like 20% of the down payment. And I was like, I think that we should like buy a house. And so he knew that I was responsible and he was like, okay. So, and of course I would say understanding the time value of money and saving and paying myself first and investing in the future. But concretely speaking is buying the house in 97.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it the same house you're living in now?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
So I would say a series of decisions would be like buying the house, getting insurance when I was young, and taking advantage of tax-deferred and tax-free accounts, those three.
All right. Well said, financial planner. You get stars for that.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Well, I think we probably need to wrap this up here because I could keep asking you questions all day long. But thanks to my guest, Margarita Cheng. And Margarita, tell people how they can get in touch with you if they have additional questions.
Sure. You can get in touch with me by visiting our website, blueoceanglobalwealth.com. You can also send me an email, mchang@blueoceanglobalwealth.com.
Okay. I think everybody got that. And to all of you in my Power of the Purse community, I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And thanks again, Margarita, for sharing your time and knowledge. And until the next time, thanks for listening. And remember, money is not the enemy. Your ignorance of it is. Goodbye.
This has been Power of the Purse with Lynn S. Evans, Certified Financial Planner. For more information and a free copy of The 7 Myths Our Mothers Taught Us About Money, visit online at womenofsubstancellc.com. That's womenofsubstancellc.com. Be sure to subscribe for more inspiring stories and information to help you take charge of your financial future. Thanks for listening.